I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. 9/11 Wake Up Call will be an hour long today. On January 24th, 2013, WNPR radio show host Colin McEnroe did a show called Newtown Truthers, Why Conspiracies Won't Quit. And 9/11 came up frequently. And after hearing the show, I knew that I had to do a show in response. And I asked Colin to come on the show, and he agreed to do it. So here he is. Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also joining me today is Steve Fournier, a local lawyer who has a lot of questions and no theories, conspiracy or otherwise. You may know him as Guy2K, host of the show on WWH on Thursday mornings at 3 a.m. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Cheryl.
Back in 2011, Colin did a show on World Trade Center Building 7 with myself and three others, and I really appreciated that. Not many people in the mainstream media do that. And I have to say, I thought that you were a closet 9/11 truther. So I was kind of surprised at the content of your show on January 24th. So I wanted to talk about that today. I took issue with nearly everything that was said on the program, but there were two things that I did agree with, so let's start there. You brought up Iraq and how people who believe that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 can't now let go of that when presented with the fact that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And so I just wanted to know, how do you think people got that false idea in the first place?
Oh, I think that idea, there's no mystery about that. The idea was circulated by the Bush administration. I think every effort was made. There was even one instance where Joe Lieberman was a literal member of the Bush administration, but long after that had been discredited, I heard him on the Don Imus show, once again, basically shopping that idea around. I mean, the idea that Iraq had something to do with 9/11 was, it came straight out of Washington.
You think there was a sufficient rebuttal or challenge from the mass media of those views?
Well, I think there was. And once again, I mean, the studies that Cheryl's alluding to that I cited on the show that she's talking about pointed out that when you confront people with the fact that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, if they already believe that, statistically, an overwhelmingly high percentage of them simply take away a confirmation of what they believed in. All they remember is Iraq and 9/11. They don't see that as a contravention of what they already believe. So, you know, whether or not the mass media did a good enough job, it almost doesn't seem to matter. It's a losing battle.
Well, maybe there's a bit of cognitive dissonance there that having done so much damage to that country that in retrospect, people have to find some sort of place to hide, you know, some sort of justification. I don't know if that's part of it, but I suppose it could be a motivating factor.
I guess it's a pretty small part of it. I mean, I just don't, unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of Americans aren't laboring under this kind of tremendously unresolved guilt about the destruction visited on Iraq. I mean, I think you can make an argument that they should be, but I don't think they are, and I don't think they're struggling.
Right, but if people think that Iraq is connected to 9/11, then they think we're justified in doing it because, you know, if we don't get them, they're going to get us kind of thing, and they already attacked us. But I didn't hear the mainstream media criticizing, you know, in fact, they were like a propaganda machine for the government going into war in Iraq. They did not challenge that very much from what I can remember.
I can't quote you chapter and verse. I can tell you that as I was a member of the mainstream media at the time. I was hosting a show on a radio station owned by CBS, and every day I made that point, every day in the run-up to the war in Iraq. I mean, my former bosses will tell you I had people flooding the executive offices with phone calls calling me a traitor and a quisling and
right,
I should be fired and stuff like that. But I said it all the time. It certainly wasn't. It wasn't not part of the debate. The mainstream media, first of all, doesn't function monolithically. You know, the mainstream media has a lot of different moving parts. And there certainly were moving parts in the mainstream media. And to whatever extent, being on WTIC, I was one of them. There were certainly moving parts making that point over and over again. Iraq had nothing to do with this.
Okay, well, in my opinion, I know you did because I had some experiences with you. And when we had speakers in their anti-war, you'd have them on and interview them. But the rest of the media was not challenging the Bush administration on Iraq. But anyway, so could we agree that going to war with Iraq and the whole buildup in the government, was that a conspiracy going on?
You know, it depends on what you call a conspiracy. you know, it certainly was a it strikes me, it struck me then, and it strikes me retrospectively as a manipulation of fact, an attempt to persuade the American public to of something that was essentially not true. So if that's a conspiracy, I don't see that as a conspiracy, but I see it more as sort of, you know, the sort of naked demagoguing of the American public.
If you take the literal definition from a legal standpoint, a conspiracy is just a combination of two people or more who agree to do some nefarious act, illegal in most cases, but not necessarily illegal. It can be, you know, against other sorts of standards. So in that sense, at least some people had to agree that there was going to be some sort of misleading information put out there. And that would be literally, I suppose, a conspiracy, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, by that definition, there are conspiracies going on all the time. And particularly conspiracies to mislead, those are everywhere. You can make the argument that they're within the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, there are misleading stories put out all the time, all over the place.
So then maybe we might say that it's a bit misleading on the part of people that criticize dissidents of various kinds on the basis that they're ideas amount to some sort of allegation of conspiracy among various players. Do you think it might be a little unfair to use that sort of terminology?
Well, first of all, to me, I think I know where you're headed here. I think, first of all, conspiracy theory is, you're right, it's a very elastic term that gets used a lot of different ways. On the show that we're talking about here, one of the terms that I started out using, we probably didn't hold to it very well all the way through the show, was counter-narrative, which to me is a more descriptive term about what I was talking about that day, where, in fact, one group has a theory that really runs counter to the accepted sequence of events about some actual moment in history.
Well, in fact, the counter-narrative to the Gulf of Tonkin story that we were fed, it turned out to be the truth. The counter-narrative was, and the counter-narrative didn't really tell us what happened. It just said, it told us what didn't happen in a way. And I think often that is what the counter-narrative is. The counter-narrative of a good deal of the Kennedy discussion is that it didn't happen the way the government said. We don't know how it happened, but it didn't have. It may have been the mafia. It may have been the Cubans. Who knows what it was? But it didn't happen the way the government said. That seems to be the counter narrative. And I think among the 9/11 in this 9/11 discussion group that I have been attending, that seems to be there. Doesn't seem to be a theory, in fact, or even an allegation of any particular kind of conspiracy or agreement, but simply a skepticism, an inability to accept the story that's been sold to us, which is a conspiracy theory, really, of the first water, I think, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that, though, that, I mean, I'll sort of hold off on that for a second as we move along. I think that it is possible to make some pretty significant distinctions. I guess I don't think you can sort of say, well, that there is a kind of global agnosticism about 9/11 that incorporates a whole bunch of viewpoints that can be lumped into one movement. I think that there are very distinct schools of agnosticism are very different from one another.
Now, yeah. I wonder why you think that, because I think if you were to attend the discussion group that we've been attending, that you would find that it really is quite a mix of people. They're all ages. And they don't tend to expound on anything except for anomalies of various kinds. And so, you know, well, I've discovered this anomaly, or, you know, this person has talked about this anomaly, or this person has found this anomaly in the dust. And that seems to be what the discussion is. So I wonder where we get the idea that there are schools, for example. I mean, is that from YouTube? Is that where you're finding that?
No. Do we want to just continue?
Sure, keep
this
going. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I think you could break it down into two different schools. And well, I'll go a little bit further in a second. I think there's one school of thought that simply says the government was less than forthcoming and, in fact, dishonest in its reaction to the questions of the 9/11 Commission and lots of other inquiries, mainly, if not exclusively, because it was trying to cover up its own incompetence. Because, in fact, there were people within the government who were aware of bin Laden and aware of the danger that he represented, attempting to brief Condoleezza Rice, attempting to brief President Bush. And because these overtures were rebuffed, they weren't taken seriously. And because residually, it's pretty clear that it's not clear that 9/11 could have been prevented, but it certainly is clear that there was a much bigger chance to prevent 9/11 than was acted upon. And that, so I'm still sort of summarizing this first school of thought. And so this first school of thought says the government was eager to cover up its own incompetence. That's one school of thought. the other school of thought is 9/11 itself didn't unfold the way that we've been told. There are ways in which the buildings collapsed that don't conform to somebody's understanding of engineering, you know, that this there may have been explosions there, that the actual fact pattern of what happened on that day is in fact drastically different, or at least that there are sufficient anomalies that, that one really can't accept the actual descriptions of the destructions of the buildings and the death of the people. And to me, those are two pretty distinct schools of thought that you can draw a bright line between.
So, Colin, if you feel that way, that what we've been told about how the buildings came down and how they actually came down are very different, what do you do with that? How do you still support the official story? Or, like, what do you do with that in your brain?
Well, let me back up and say a couple of things about that. First of all, I should say, just to be clear about one of the first things you said, I'm not a closet 9/11 truther. I am of that first school, emphatically of that first school. I believe the government was incompetent, that they were eager to cover up their incompetence, and that they were not truthful in their dealings with the 9/11 Commission. But I think it was entirely because this was a more preventable event than they wanted anyone to know. Now, let's sort of go to this whole question, what if you believe this other stuff? And let's go back to the first show that you mentioned. I think I'm close to unique in the mainstream media in terms of wanting to actually do a show in which that whole argument, the argument that you represent, got aired. And with, as you perhaps remember from that time, a tremendous amount of pushback from my own staff, I said, we're going to do this show. And I also said, we're not going to have anybody on to argue with you guys. If you recall, there wasn't anybody there in the studio saying, no, no, that's not the way it happened.
No, except for the little Patrick Scahill attack.
But. No, he was my producer. My producer really didn't want to do this show. And I said, first of all, you're excused from doing the show. You know, we'll produce it without you. And I said, actually, I'd love to have an essay from you about why you don't think we should do the show. And so, yeah, I wanted his point. But, you know, I mean, I could have done it in a much more adversarial way. I could have had somebody in there within the studio with you who believed the opposite. And my reason for not doing that is I feel like that's the already accepted body of truth. It really didn't make any sense to me to have a ping pong match with you there in the studio arguing with somebody who basically represents, say, the embodied truths of the 9/11 Commission. I just didn't think there was any point in doing that. I thought, yeah, let's have a couple people in here who are from this movement and just let them talk. Let them talk. And I mean, I had some questions for you, but, you know, just let them talk. And I think I am almost unique in the mainstream media. And the response, certainly nationally to that show, it's in many ways, I think, the most listened to podcast that WNPR has. And let me just tell you why I did it. The reason, because it's sort of, I'm trying to be responsive to your question. What do you do with that? I think it's good that we have a country where there are people who can believe something really radically different from the accepted narrative. I think that's basically a healthy thing. And I'm invariably getting a lot of pushback from my own profession whenever I say, so just put it on the air. Let them talk. You know, let them talk. What's going to happen?
Well, how do you explain that pushback? What's your explanation for that? Why would this be why can't this be talked about?
Well, I'm with you, first of all. I mean,
how do you explain them? They're journalists, aren't they? Isn't it a natural thing for them to want to talk about things like this?
I would think so. Well, first of all, if you listen to the more
this
recent...
This makes us suspicious. You understand right?
I think one of the arguments is these... I'm trying to sum up somebody else's argument. I may not be doing a good job, but one thing I sometimes hear is these claims are so outlandish and possibly even kind of hurtful to people whose families, to families of people who died in 9/11, things like that. You hear that.
You credit that one?
No, I mean, I say I'm trying.
Do you believe them when they say that? Do you believe that's really their motive, is to spare the feelings of some family members? Do you think that?
I think in some cases, yeah. I mean, certainly when we did this Newtown show, that was certainly an argument. That show I also had to fight to get on the air. People didn't want to do it at first. It took a long time to convince people that we would even do that show. I then wanted to have somebody on the show who actually represented that point of view, and I was gradually talked out of that by everybody. But I think... You know, it's also, if you listen to that show, it was at one point we had this Dartmouth professor on who was opposed to having, I think it was from Dartmouth, who was opposed to even covering these kinds of stories. And it was sort of interesting because it was a different conversation than the one that you want to have here. He wasn't even willing to have a conversation with me about whether to put these things on the air because they might be true. He thought these kinds of stories aren't true. And you shouldn't even put them on the air for the purpose of discrediting them.
But Colin, on the show, I thought you agreed with him. I thought I heard you say that you thought we were dangerous, that we were blurring the base with the fringe, and that concerned you. And
what I said, well, I don't even exactly know what I said. I'll tell you what I think now, and I hope it lines up with what I said on the air. What I think is, what I was trying to say to him was, if you don't ever cover things like this, if you, in fact, you shove them back into the corner, well, first of all, assume for a moment that these counter-narratives are not true, then they tend to grow and create, as you just suggested, an atmosphere of distrust in basic institutions. Whether they're true or not, they tend to grow and create an atmosphere of distrust.
Do you trust institutions, knowing what you know?
I don't trust all institutions. I believe in questioning authority. I believe in asking questions. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's interesting, Colin, because the one message that I took away from your whole show was that people shouldn't question, and that if you do question, you're going to be ridiculed and called names like, you know, idiotic and toxic and psychologically deranged were some of the
troll.
You know, those were some of the terms that, you know, only a few of the terms that were, it was thrown out a lot on the show. So that sent the message to me, you know, don't speak out or you're going to be ridiculed if you question your government.
Well, first of all, I mean, a lot of the terms that you, I don't know how many of those terms I personally use, but maybe I used some of them, but I believe I used them about the people who were claiming that Newtown didn't happen as had been represented. People who were running videos saying that there were actors hired to portray grieving parents, that there were actors hired to portray children, that this whole thing was a false flag.
And, you know, I even agree with you on those, that those are crazy things, crazy ideas.
I think a lot of the people doing that do fit the category
right, but,
of trolls.
But I think the problem with your show is that you lumped, not you, you and your speakers, you lumped all of these, quote, conspiracy theories or counter-narratives, I prefer that term, together and didn't distinguish or separate out. And certainly, you know, not everybody in the 9/11 truth movement is believing all those other things. So, or, you know, and vice versa. So I think it was an unfair way to do that and lump us all together.
Well, you know, it may have been, first of all. It may have been. And I'd have to go back and listen to the show and listen to how the conversation unfolded. I mean, our goal was primarily to do a show about these sort of Newtown counter-narratives. Now, in order to do the show, we wound up talking to people who had historians and academics who had sort of specialized in these counter-narratives and so-called conspiracy theories. And to a certain degree, you can lump them together. And then to another degree, in another way, it's grotesquely unfair to lump them all together. And maybe there was too much conflation of the two. But, I mean, you know, in some ways, they can be lumped together. They do represent radically different ways of telling a story that the public thinks that it knows.
Well, let's get to one of these counter-narratives. And
Steve, can I just ask you to hold that for 1 minute?
Okay.
Because I'm getting farther away from
it. Go ahead.
I had asked the question earlier, what do you do in your mind to separate out the fact that you believe that the government somehow, you know, there were explosions in the way the buildings came down, that in or the story differs from the official story, and yet you still believe the official story. How do you do that? I'm curious to know where you go with that.
First of all, I don't believe there were explosions that happened differently. What I believe, once again, to say it again, is I believe that the government was incompetent in its handling of counterintelligence, incompetent in handling the intelligence it had available, and eager to cover up that fact. I don't believe that there were mysterious explosions in the building or that the buildings were destroyed in some other way.
Including 7? What is your explanation for 7?
I'm not an expert in this. I mean, I'm certainly...
Are you disturbed by the lack of an explanation?
I hope I didn't come here representing myself as anybody who's prepared to argue that out, or I mean, I don't have the kind of command of details that you guys have.
I know, but Colin, if you do a show and you're calling us mentally deranged,
I don't think I ever called you mentally deranged.
On the show.
He said psychologically
damaged. The Dartmouth guy.
Unstable.
Oh, well, I mean, I certainly didn't call.
Well, toxic was one of the terms that you said. And
about the Newtown conspiracies. I mean, I think it's sort of weird that you're going after me about this, because, you know, there were a lot of people when you were on who were saying, why are you putting those people on and letting them have their say? And a lot of people were also saying, why don't you have somebody there to present the other side? Now, in this case, I had a whole bunch of different people on, and they were saying stuff maybe about you that you don't like so much. But the sort of consistent part of all this is, I'm letting people come on and say certain things and have their say. You know, the day that you were on, I made no attempt to discredit you or have anybody on who was going to argue back with you. My thought was, it's your day, have your say. On the show that you're talking about, yeah, there were other people on, and they were saying stuff about people who traffic in conspiracy theories, and some of those things may not be things that are all that palatable to you. But, okay, so that on that particular day, for that particular 10 minutes that they were talking, they were saying something that you don't agree with. You got an hour on my show to say stuff that a lot of people don't agree with. I think it's sort of all okay, you know?
Well, no, because they were calling us toxic extremist. I mean, there
Most
were lots
of that
of,
was about Newtown. I mean, I'd have to go out and listen to the show and see whether there were situations where you
It was about 9/11 also. And as I said, a lot of times it was all together and I couldn't tell, you know, they didn't separate it out. It was just people who held, quote, conspiracy theories in general. So, and to me, if I don't think you can separate out people who want the truth about 9/11 from the evidence, because it's the evidence that drives us, because there's so much, there's a huge mountain of evidence that contradicts the official story. And so, if you do that, then you can't really criticize us if you don't know the evidence, is what I'm saying. And they were doing that without presenting any evidence.
Yeah, this wasn't really a show about you guys, though. I mean, it was primarily a show about the Newtown stuff. You know, you crept in with some of the guests as examples of another kind of counter-narrative. My recollection, I do five shows a week and 250 shows a year, and after a while, I don't remember them all that specifically. But my recollection was when I was talking to the guy from Dartmouth at one point, he was once again making the argument, you shouldn't even acknowledge that people exist when they believe something that's completely radically different from the accepted narrative. I was disagreeing with him. And at one point he said, well, it should at least have somebody well-known and respected attached to it. That was one of his arguments. He had this whole set of litmus tests for at what point you even report on something enough to be wanting to discredit it. Never mind, you know, allowing for the possibility some of it might be true. And he said it should have somebody well-known attached to it. And I think at that point I might have brought up the 9/11 truthers and said, well, they don't really have anybody well-known attached to them. And they've grown and grown and grown. And part of the reason that they've grown and grown and grown, you know, is that they've kind of grown in the shade because nobody ever talks about them or writes about them or, you know, why not?
Does that bother you that this topic seems to be taboo? Is it something, as a journalist, is it something that bothers you?
It does bother me. It's why I did that show. But it doesn't bother me because I think the truth is being suppressed.
Oh, you don't think that?
No. I mean, not at least not about sort of how, but what I believe in is a free exchange of ideas. I believe in your right to come on my show and say what you believe about the buildings and stuff like that. I believe in the right of somebody else to come on my show and say you guys are nuts. What I believe is in the free flow of ideas. I get very scared when people start making a lot of rules about, oh, no, you can't do a show about 9/11 truthers. They're too weird. They're too crazy. They're too toxic. My answer to that was, no, let's do the show about them. Let's have the conversation. And I also believe that the people who think that you're crazy and toxic can come on the air and say that, too.
Now, when you confront an anomaly, as you did when Cheryl came on, okay, the anomaly of Building 7. And there are so many anomalies with it. I mean, for one thing, there's the fact that it was standing and people were reporting that it had come down. And then the fact that it came down at all, wasn't hit by any airplane, never. It's a skyscraper. Skyscrapers don't just fall down, not from a fire. Or at least that seems to be what the law of physics would tell us. It's an unprecedented event. And I'm wondering, as somebody that informs people, as somebody that reports facts, what you do with an anomaly like that. I mean, you tell me, okay, I'm not an engineer and I'm not an expert on this, but don't you have an obligation to find experts, to find out what did that and to get to the bottom of it? Or don't you have an obligation in that way?
I think there should be reporting on that. I mean, once again, it's not really what I do for a living. You know, as I say, I do 250 shows a year since I got to WNPR. Therefore, I've done maybe almost 1,000 shows. I did one of them about 9/11. I'm really not somebody who can take a month out of my life and start talking to engineering experts and figure out how Building 7 fell down. I think that's, you know, if there's a substantial climate of questioning about it, which in making the argument to do the show that you were on, one of the things that I said to people who thought it was a bad idea is, no, there are conferences about this and they are not attended by five people in dirty bathrobes. You know, they're attended by intelligent people who are, you know, some of them are college professors. There's a conversation going on about this and it deserves to be taken at least that seriously. You know, it's not 25 crackpots with colanders on their heads. You know, it's people that you know, that you see. But is it specifically my job to figure out how Building 7 fell down? No. You know, I mean, somebody like Lawrence Wright, you know, somebody who can spend a year going over data, that's that person's job. I'm much more of a generalist.
Yes, but what about the phenomenon of believing what you're seeing? You know, from the point of view of the people that are discussing this issue, when we talk about conspiracy, we see that theory that's being propounded by the government is really a bizarre conspiracy theory. And then from the point of view of whether somebody is nuts or not, you know, we say, well, we're believing what we saw. You know, we saw buildings come down as if they had been destroyed by demolition. And this is what we saw. I mean, it's right there in front of you. And yet, what you call the predominant view, I don't know if it really is, but let's assume for the sake of argument that the predominant view is that these things just collapsed in their own cellars. And, you know, who's crazy? The Dartmouth guy said these people are nuts for believing their eyes. And we say, well, who's nuts? Isn't it the guy that doesn't believe his eyes?
You know, this isn't entirely responsive to what you just said, but it's some of this stuff is coming back to me now. I'm remembering things a little bit. One of the things that did happen after we did the show about 9/11 truthers is a number of people came to me and said, or emailed me or whatever, and said, well, and I'm sure you're quite aware of these, there are specific rebuttal sites that exist where people are rebutting you guys. And they claim to have an answer for every anomaly that you bring up. And then the question being, well, should I have gone and found one of those guys and had them on with you? Or should I do another show where I have somebody from one of the rebuttal sites? And once again, my answer to that was, and I hope this doesn't seem like I'm ducking it or passing the buck, but I felt it was important to just to acknowledge that there was a substantial body of people who had questions about this. I don't have the same questions. I have certain things about 9/11 that I'm not comfortable with. I don't have those questions. I haven't obsessed about them. I haven't stressed about them. They're just not things that I am not prepared to believe.
Do you think the mystery is solved? Do you think the crime is solved?
I'm not at least in the thrall of a compelling mystery about how the buildings came down. But it's also, I freely confess, this is not something that I've specialized in or taken a huge interest in. I mean, I take an interest in a whole bunch of different things, and I hate to keep coming back to this, but one of my jobs is to do 250 very different shows a year. I mean, I don't know what the show was after the Newtown show or the show after the show about yours, but I can guarantee you it was nothing like the show that we did. So I'm just not immersing myself in physical, technical questions about how these buildings came down. I understand that they exist, and I was happy to put them on the air for a day. But am I prepared to sit here and have a big argument with you about how the buildings came down? No, I'm not a master of those kinds of details.
That's understandable, certainly. And so we can say then that, or we can assume that at some point in the future, you probably will confront this again at some point, just because it's something to talk about. You have points of disagreement with the government's conspiracy theory too. Is that correct?
I have points of disagreement, the ones that I just mentioned about, yes, how the government explained this. And let me just say this too, since I'm now I'm kind of sensing the tenor of this show. I am very interested. I was happy to put your movement on the air. I'm happy to put you on the air.
And we were appreciative of that.
But I do think that you guys do stuff that, not you specifically, but the 9/11 truth movement. I've seen you cherry pick stuff too. And I'll give you an example too, because I was thinking about it just today. I didn't really realize we were going to go here but in this conversation. But so if you go on a lot of sites that are essentially 9/11 truth sites, one of the quotes that you'll often see is a quote from Harper's Magazine. They'll say, Harper's Magazine ran this article, and the quote, the quote, I can't sum it up perfectly, but it's just something like, the 9/11 Commission report is a cheat and a fraud, and it infantilizes the citizenry by transforming candor into iniquity. And it goes on like that. And it's on the sites as a pull quote. And what's not clear, inevitably, is that this is an essay by Benjamin DeMott. It's a tremendous essay, and it sums up brilliantly a lot of the problems that I have with the official version of 9/11. But all of DeMott's essay is about the whole question of the government essentially covering up its counterintelligence failures, the fact that Bush and Cheney really had a much better chance as an administration to fight this and prevent this than what they exercised. And because of their incompetence, you know, they lied and covered up. You know, it's not an essay in support of Building 7 fell down a whole different way. Then it's not about that. But, you know, I do feel it, though, if the movement's committed to truth, then that's kind of sneaky, you know? I mean, it makes it look like Harper's Magazine and Benjamin DeMott think what 9/11 truthers typically think. And they don't. They think what I think. And I'm interested in your movement. I respect what you guys do, that it's important to have dissident voices. But if you're going to crusade for truth, then you really ought to be above board in all ways. You should never say inflate the credentials of somebody who takes your side. You should never inflate the number of people who take your side.
And
you shouldn't pull quotes out of Benjamin DeMott's articles that make it look like he thinks something that he doesn't.
Well, and I have to say, Colin, I've never, ever seen that article. Mm. But I would agree with you, if people have done it, that that's not the right thing to do. You know, we're a big movement, and we have all sorts of people who do things. And,
I'm bringing this up because you're holding me accountable on this show for things that were said by guests on my show. So I'm saying, all right, well, we can this accountability thing, it happens all over the place. And that show that I did may have been imperfect in certain ways, and people may have said things that you disagree with. But this is a raucous debate that we're having, not just about 9/11, but democracy, American life, public life is a raucous debate. It should be a debate. There will be times when you will hear things, you know, that you radically disagree with. There will be times when the arguments aren't presented the way that you would like to hear them presented, and at a nuanced level aren't produced. But there will be times where your movement does the same thing. And I'm not saying, I didn't bring up the example I brought up to discredit your movement. I'm saying that kind of stuff happens. You know, it just happens. So that show that you're upset about, it may not have been the perfect show. I don't ever do a perfect show.
Well, I don't think I want to. I'm speaking for myself now. I don't think I want to hold you accountable for your guest. I think I want to find out what went through your mind when your guest said certain views. I can't think what the term extreme views should be edited out. I think that was his term. Extreme views should be kept out of the discussion. And it seemed to me that this is something that should just get you going. You know,
no,
you're a journalist. I mean, how do you sit there? And so that's what I want to do. I want to find out what was happening to you when he said that. Did you say, "Are you nuts?"
I disagree. I don't want to say that. Are you nuts? But I disagree.
Head,
with
yeah.
I disagree with them. I think it was clear on the air that I disagreed with them. The way public radio, I mean, if I was still on TIC having that conversation, I might have called them nuts, or I wouldn't have called them nuts, but I would have said that's arrogant. Because I think there was, in the standards that he was setting up for any kind of reporting or any kind of consideration of kind of outside the mainstream movements, I thought those standards they're unworkable and they're not good, you know? Now, well, I'll stop there.
Did you notice the term that he used a term? And he was referring specifically to 9/11 skeptics. I don't use that term, 9/11 truthers, because I think if you were to ask people, what do you think happened in a group of people that don't buy the government account, that you would find that nobody would be able to say. You know, they might say, well, it might have been this, might have been that. But you won't find a consistent conspiracy theory among people that doubt the government's account. You just won't.
Yeah.
And so I think it's more of a 9/11 skeptic. You know, I think of it as the 9/11 skeptics and the 9/11 deniers is the way that it comes in my mind. But I guess from my point of view, it looks so much like a whole area of discussion has to be suppressed because of the potential damage. The guy did say that we were dangerous, you know. And I think that, and he used the term disturbingly intelligent, which I thought was a pretty interesting little piece of rhetoric. I didn't know what he meant by that.
You print up T-shirts.
Yeah,
disturbingly intelligent.
Yeah, you would wear that.
Yeah,
I think you might be entitled to wear that T-shirt. But, you know, I think you have to concede that the doubters have good reason to doubt. There's so much that is edited out. I don't know if you follow around the anniversary, if you follow any of the coverage that's on, but I think you'll find that there's very, very little discussion of what happened on that day, and a considerable amount of discussion about the mosque that they're building down the street and the tower that's going up and peripheral things. But discussion of what actually happened on that day is lacking. And so from my point of view, I just wonder how that could be. It seems as if the mystery remains unsolved. And it should be talked about until it's solved. They carted away all the evidence, for God's sakes. Rudy Giuliani is going to be making a speech at Central in a couple of weeks. And he's responsible for taking away this physical evidence that we could be using to find out who did this thing. If they really didn't find the passport of one of the people on the ground that fluttered down, I suppose, from the 81st floor or something. You can see that, you know, we find these explanations preposterous. And, you know, that's why we press, I think. But I don't think I want to press you to say that you did anything wrong. I think I want to find out how you square your own intellect, your own cognition with the things that people are trying to pass by you. Like, you know, don't have this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't do this show.
I guess what I would say about that is, and this is sort of, I mean, and I think in some ways we agree about more than we disagree about. We may not. I can't join you in a highly technical conversation about 9/11 and Building 7 and stuff like that. But to me, one of the questions that kind of led to the show that you were on and then the subsequent show. I feel as though journalism doesn't really know how to cover all kinds of different stories that fall outside the conventional narrative, you know, and it's not good at differentiating stories that are really beyond the pale from stories that maybe deserve a little bit more debate. And I don't know how to do that either. I think it's an interesting question. So, I mean, you use the term denier. So you got Holocaust deniers. People basically say the Holocaust didn't happen, you know, or didn't happen the way that we've been told. Or
I don't know a single one of them. I don't know a single one of them.
But they exist. I know that they exist. Well, I mean, Farrakhan, mm-hmm. for example. Okay. And Ahmadinejad basically says the Holocaust. There are deniers. There are people who say the Holocaust didn't happen. Okay. So they're one group. Let's pick another group. Okay, for a long time on this radio station, a very old and very dear and now departed friend of mine, George Michael Ivica, used to do this show called Assassination Journal, which, you know, started out as his response to feeling as though the Kennedy assassination had not been explained sufficiently, but then became this kind of marvelous and almost impossible to follow at times, but wonderfully kind of poetic exploration of all kinds of American counter-narratives. I mean, are you guys around for that show?
Every Tuesday,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it was, mm-hmm. I always listened. I mean, half the time I didn't know what George Michael was talking about, but, you know, because if you came in the middle of it, you just weren't going to be able to pick it up. But I loved that show was there, you know, and so that was about, I mean, well beyond George Michael is this gigantic set of alternative theories about the Kennedy assassination. So then you got that. And we could go along. And all these things, they're not all the same, you know. They're Holocaust deniers and Kennedy assassination deniers and 9/11 deniers and Newtown deniers. They're not all the same, but they do represent a phenomenon that journalism has to come to grips with. And the phenomenon is, well, do you dismiss all of them as utterly beyond the pale, or do you set up a continuum and say, okay, well, the Holocaust deniers are really weird and disgusting and sick, and they don't deserve even to have their claims analyzed. You know, and the Kennedy stuff is really complicated and reticulated, and, you know, we sort of been there, we've done that, and there's really no point in even trying to get at it anymore because people are dug into whatever positions they have. I mean, it's each one of these things deserves to be dealt with separately, but they also represent one global question for journalism, which is, to what degree are we going to look at this stuff and how are we going to rank it?
But Colin, and maybe that's a sensitive issue for us in the 9/11 truth movement, because we have been totally, for the most part, censored and blocked out from any kind of mainstream media, with a few exceptions. So to think that there are people back there saying, you know, should we cover this or not? In some ways, it sounds like, why don't you just present the truth? I mean, give them the facts. Maybe not the truth is the wrong term, but give them the facts of what people are saying on the different arguments and let the listeners decide.
Well, that's, of course, what I did the day that you were on the show. But let me just say another thing about that, because maybe this is helpful. This comes from, you know, I spent the first 20 years of my career at a daily newspaper and then the rest of the time on the radio, some overlap. But and I think a lot of the resistance you get isn't ideological. It's more functional in nature. And I had one editor who used to have this rule called the 3-minute mile rule. And basically it was, if a guy comes into the city room and says he just ran a 3-minute mile, he probably didn't. All right. And it really doesn't make sense for you to spend the afternoon going down to Herb's sports shop and getting a stopwatch and going out to the field with him to make sure that he can't run the mile in 3 minutes, because it's so unlikely that he could do it. That, I mean, you know, if you got time or that's what you're, but in terms of journalistic allocation of resources, we don't investigate every single claim that everybody makes, because if you're at a daily newspaper or a big radio station, people making, if I showed you the email that I got all the time, not just from individuals, but from people who have publicists, you know, and a lot of it would really astonish you at the, you know, so where somebody has hired a publicist and sent out mass emailings to every radio station in the country, making some claim that would really shock you and that you would find, you know. And so I'm not going to do a show about every single one of those claims. I have to, every single journalist has to make a series of discernments there. Like, how are you going to allocate your resources? Now, a lot of journalists look at this and say, you know what? I don't think the government is really capable of pulling off a conspiracy where buildings at 9/11 would be destroyed or fall down in some kind of surreptitiously managed way, you know, and pull this off. It doesn't pass that 3-minute mile test. I think that's the resistance you're getting.
But maybe, Colin, I know you said you don't have time, but if people would, instead of, you know, when you hear conspiracy theory, anything following that is invalidated, right? So, but maybe if you would look in, and other people would look into some of these issues, you would see that there's more to it than that. And for example, the Muckraker magazine asked the FBI why they didn't have Osama bin Laden wanted for 9/11. It was back in 2006. And their chief of investigative publicity said, because we have no hard evidence linking Osama bin Laden to 9/11. This is the FBI saying this. And the corporate media did not pick up on it at all. And to me, that's a huge piece of news. I mean, that could alter the whole face of the event in people's minds, that for the FBI to say that they don't have any evidence linking Osama bin Laden to it when we're fighting in Afghanistan and chasing supposedly Al-Qaeda around the world and killing people and spending billions of dollars. To me, that's a pretty important issue that gets ignored.
If, in fact, that's exactly what happened. And I just don't, I don't know. I mean, I find it hard to believe that somebody...
Well, but that's what I'm saying.
Could have been the cleaning guy.
Can I ask you this?
His name was Rex Toome. Check it out.
Right. Here's when the guy said this is dangerous, certain topics are just dangerous to discuss and shouldn't be discussed. What came into my mind was that certainly if it's true that the buildings were brought down with explosives and thermite, as seems to be the case, that if that happened, then somebody destroyed them with people in them, two of them. People were in there, and somebody did that. And whoever those people were have not been brought to justice if it happened that way. And certainly they would have to be well-placed people to do that, to have rigged those buildings to go off. I think that it's, as far as Building 7 is concerned, the evidence is pretty telling that somebody put explosives there at some point before that. I don't know how many buildings in New York might be rigged to go off at any time. I don't know. There may be many of them, maybe all of them. I don't know. But in any case, if it happened the way that it seems to have happened, what I saw with my eyes, then people who haven't been punished are in high places. And if we were to catch up with them and if justice were to be dispensed to them, it would be a disaster for this country. It would discredit large portions of the American government. It would mean that the Air Force stood down in order to allow this to happen. It would be an awful thing. And so it is dangerous. And so it seems to me that the investigation that people are demanding, the new investigation, would be necessary in order to dispel this suspicion. I wonder how you feel about that. And I don't mean as a journalist, even. I mean just as a guy from Hartford.
As a guy from Hartford, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question you just asked, but as a guy from Hartford, first of all...
That it would bring down large portions of the government.
If that were true, yes, it would be...
Should you stay away from the question if it has that potential?
I wouldn't stay away from the... No, I mean, look, we're both from a similar generation. We both went through Watergate. You know, Watergate was a conspiracy that turned out to be true, and that did involve huge stretches of the government. I would also say I went through another conspiracy here in Connecticut, which was the administration of John Rowland, in which, you know, he ultimately did plead guilty to being part of a criminal conspiracy, in which the government was fundamentally corrupted by the activities of a group of people who were subverting the ways in which contracts
were awarded. And there were people that didn't want to discuss that either.
There were.
Because of the damage that would be done, weren't there?
Well, I don't know about the damage that wouldn't be done. But first of all, you didn't have any trouble getting the press interested in it, you know? I mean, the Current went after it. I went after it. Everybody went after it. If there's any kind of substance, I didn't want to say blood in the water, but if there's any kind of substance, you usually get the press pretty interested in something like this because the press doesn't want to not cover the story of the century. I mean, the Rowland scandal was, you know, the story of many decades in Connecticut. Watergate was the story of many decades in American political life.
Except 9/11, this
story, I'm assuming, kind of an Oliver Wendell Holmesian invisible hand argument here. I'm assuming if there was really something to work with, journalists who were really interested in this story, a guy like Lawrence Wright, who wrote The Looming Tower, would be really, really interested if he felt there was a substantial body of evidence that there are New York writers at The New Yorker and The Nation and, you know, and Mother Jones and publications all across America, investigative reporters who really are capable of taking a tremendous amount of time to analyze something like this and get a book contract to write about it. I'm assuming if there's a story there, they either would have found it or they will find it, that there aren't restraints on them. You know, there isn't anybody telling Mother Jones they can't cover this story.
When you see the video of the Twin Towers falling, the two videos, does it raise a suspicion in you?
No, I mean, I haven't ever looked at that video and thought, wow, that isn't just from airplanes flying into them.
You haven't?
No.
Okay.
Now we have 1,774 architects and engineers to date saying that, and they're all scientists, you know, and they're saying that the official story, the official science of how the towers collapsed is physically impossible. It defies the laws of physics. So, you know, there's these 1,774 people out there saying this, and their total silence, for the most part, in the mainstream media and even in the left-leaning media. And, you know, we don't understand it other than they're getting the word that they can't talk about it.
Yeah, I don't think there's, I mean, like, I worked at a lot of different big corporations. You know, I worked for Times Mirror. I worked for CBS. I work for National Public Radio now, or sort of at least a, you know, an outlet of National Public Radio. There just isn't a memo that comes down that says, you know, you can't cover this. You can't do this. Stay away from this.
Well, we know what our employers don't want us to do. We don't need a memo, do we?
You know, look, I should say at NPR, the pressure that I got about not doing the story about the 9/11 skeptics or in the Newtown truthers or whatever you want to call them. They didn't come from any boss I had or anything like that. It came from people really more aptly described as people who work for me. You know, they came from the rest of the staff of the show, you know, and I don't think there is that. But just back to what you were saying, because there are 1,774 architects or engineers or whatever, that was why you were on my show, you know, because I thought, well, you know, there's, as I say, you know, we can start to kind of rank some of these things. And we could sort of say, all right, well, if five Holocaust deniers show up in my office tomorrow, I'm probably still not going to do a show on Holocaust deniers. It's still weird and creepy and doesn't really have a lot of substance behind it. Even, you know, and even if you could marshal a better case and say, well, okay, but I hear, but what about this guy? What about this guy? What about, was David Irving? Was he one of the guys who wrote books about this? I still probably wouldn't do the show. You know, I just don't really think that there, I mean, it's just so clear that the Holocaust happened. All right. So we can rank that down at the bottom of the totem pole. And then the next question is sort of, well, where are you guys on the totem pole? You know? And I sort of thought, well, I think you're high enough on the totem pole. So yeah, I'll do a show about it. And I'll tell you another thing about that show, which was we entered that show in a national contest. And Patrick, who didn't want to do the show in the first place, he was one of the people who said, you know what? Screw it. Let's enter it. Let's put this, you know, we did the show that nobody else would do. We didn't win, but I mean, at the end of the day, we were, even Patrick, who was very, very reluctant to do the show, we were pleased enough that we'd done the show that, but anyway, that's why we did it, because of exactly what you said.
And did you say that show, as archived, gets, had a lot of...
Tremendous amount of interest from all over the country. Now, the reason for that is pretty clear, just looking at comments and even data usage patterns and stuff like that. There's a lot of you guys, and you don't get a lot of mainstream coverage. So this is a rare instance of a quote-unquote legit mainstream media outlet doing an hour about your points of view.
And do you think that the lack of attention that it gets elsewhere, okay, you did give it some attention, and I think you're to be commended for that, but do you think that the lack of attention that we're seeing in general is because we're not high enough on the pole or because of the potential for harm that culpability would have?
You know, I feel like I don't have the right to answer that question, but I mean, I'll attempt something of an answer to it. I guess I have a hard time accepting that idea that the harm would be too great. You know, I mean, the mainstream media is not perfect, and it's owned by big corporations, and yeah, they're probably not ultimate. And with each passing year, you know, it becomes less diverse and more corporatized. And so this process, you know, it gets less and less likely to be able to topple some kind of existing very important narrative. But I still think it has that capacity. And it's still diverse enough. And it's still, I mean, nobody's telling The Nation, you know, or Mother Jones that it can't do that article. So my sense is it's more of a totem pole issue. You know, that, and I'm just picking on The Nation and Mother Jones, but I'm sure you could think of.
You know, I wonder about that because I say, well, of course, The Nation, you know, they depend on subscribers, but they have their contributors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe there is a contributor that says, and doesn't even have to say out loud, but a contributor, a big contributor that we know that if we touch this topic, that's going to be the end of that contributor. I mean, I don't know if that actually happens, but it's something that could happen. And it's something that seems as if it would happen under certain circumstances, and this might be one of those. And so it's you can't believe how easy it is to form suspicions once you get started on it.
No, I can. And it's interesting to hear you say that, too, because I think that's sort of part of the dilemma, you know, the dilemma for people who passionately believe a counter-narrative. And that's not even generalized to that degree. Let's talk about you guys. At the end of the day, you're really kind of stuck with this question. Is there this kind of silent, semi-passive conspiracy to keep this ever from being discussed? Or is it just somehow or they're not rising to the level of journalistic
interest?
Right,
we wanted to throw that question at you.
For me, you know my answer.
I know the answer now.
I mean, it doesn't rise to a level of journalistic interest that I'm willing to quit my job and try to get a Guggenheim grant and a book contract so I can spend a year or two of my life sifting through forensic evidence, because I'm not good at that. I've never done that with anything else either. You know, that's not who I am. It's not what I do. But I thought it was interesting enough. What I thought was interesting was exactly what you said, that there are professionals, you know, who look at this stuff and have a real problem with it. And that there are conferences that, as I say, are not attended by three people. They're attended by hundreds of people, and they happen on college campuses, not in dark alleyways. I just thought, you know, it's worth it for part of being an informed American. And I think I did say this on the more objectionable show. Part of being an informed American is kind of understanding the full climate of opinion, not just the main body of opinion, but the full climate. You know, that's part of informing people is, if I'm going to inform people, I can't just inform them about what Richard Gephardt thinks. I got to tell them what you think too, you know. But then there is some little dark corner that you can get chased into. Well, then am I obliged to inform people? I think you do have to inform people, you know, what Louis Farrakhan thinks too. And we do, you know. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes more of a question, well, how do you characterize that stuff? Do you characterize it all as wingnut stuff, or do you give it some kind of legitimacy? And how much legitimacy do you give it?
Right. Colin, one thing you did say on the show that kind of made me chuckle a little bit was that there are some, we were talking to one of the guys about what motivates, quote, conspiracy theorists. And one of them was that they were motivated by, you know, profit. They were becoming entrepreneurs.
Talking about you guys. Let's just put it this way. I wasn't talking about you guys. It is clear. I mean, unless Alex Jones is one of you guys. I don't even know where he comes out on the night. Yeah. But I mean, a guy like Alex Jones is making a lot of money.
Is he making a lot of money?
I think he's making making more
right,
money.
But we're like, according to this latest poll, 84% of the people, you know, like kind of question the government. So, you know, there may be one Alex Jones making money, but the rest of us aren't. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Well, what I was saying there was that, yes, and it seems to me in the case of the Newtown guys that there are people who are creating sites that pull a lot of traffic in, you know, they get 10 million hits on a video. There seems to be an entrepreneurial quality in some of that stuff. I wouldn't ascribe that. I've never sensed that with any of the people agnostic group that you are part of.
Even the group of people at the hockey game that you were talking about, you didn't really think that they were nuts. Or did you? I mean,
no,
you didn't think that they were out of contact with reality. Yeah. You thought they were, what, morbid curiosity maybe?
Just to put that in context for listeners. So one of the sort of driving things that helped me sell this idea to myself and other people around me of doing a show about Newtown conspiracy theories or counter-narratives was that I'd heard a story about a bunch of West Hartford hockey moms at a hockey practice, and they were passing somebody's smartphone around that had the 10 million hit video, basically saying that Newtown did not happen, was not the massacre, it was staged, it was actors and stuff like that. And it wasn't exactly that same thing. It wasn't a bunch of people, you know, in some cell somewhere. It wasn't even a bunch of people in a New York coffee house in the Lower East Side, you know. It was at a West Hartford hockey practice. Moms are looking at this thing. And I don't know what they're thinking about it. I don't know whether it's morbid curiosity or a real, although, once again, this is all kind of secondhand, but I was told by one of the people there that one of the moms said, no, I think there's some real merit here. There's some real questions here that need to be answered. So, you know, once again, my point was, part of informing you, the public, about what the climate of opinion is, okay, I got to do this show, you know, because it's, once again, it's not so esoteric that you know, that it doesn't come up at a West Hartford hockey practice. So
I was grateful to find out what the Dartmouth professor thought, because I would never have found out that otherwise. I don't know if he has any audience or not, but it was a bizarre view that I thought he had, and really counter to what I know you believe from just reading your stuff. I'm sure that you wouldn't have accepted that, but I thought you didn't really give him as much of an argument as I was expecting you to go after him. And maybe you don't do that. Maybe that's
not
not the way to do it on your program.
Yeah, and some of your guests on there were entrepreneurs themselves making money off of studying conspiracies. So, you know, and then they were flinging that out at us, that label that we were. So anyway, unfortunately, we're almost out of time today. Do either of you have any final comments you'd like to make?
Yes, I think that this was very beneficial. I hope you don't feel as if you got ambushed.
No, I was a little surprised at the beginning, but no, I think it's a good conversation too. Look, I've said what my bag is here. My bag is, you know, in general, it's good to discuss stuff. And when you discuss stuff, you sort out your own thoughts better, too. I mean, even in the conversation we've had here, it's helped me think a little bit more about why am I drawn to do these shows that nobody else wants to do?
And maybe that's why.
Yeah. I think part of it is that it needs to be talked about. It needs to be thought about. And because journalism needs a better set of standards. Like, I didn't agree with the guy from Dartmouth. We need a better set of standards. Here are these ideas that are off the menu somehow. So how do we look at them? Do we never look at them? You know, no, I don't think so.
Well, then think of this as encouragement to keep on doing that.
Right.
Colin, I just wanted to add that there is a guy who's been hired by the Obama administration as the administrator of his Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, and he thinks that we're dangerous and has co-written an article containing a plan to prevent the spread of anti-government conspiracy theories, in which he suggests that the government use agents to cognitively infiltrate these groups, and particularly 9/11, in order to break them up. And so some of your speakers to me sounded like they were coming right out of his playbook. And there's a few other guys who have written books, like Jonathan Kay wrote a book, Among the Truthers, where they don't present any of the evidence, but they do a lot of ad hominem attacks. And so, and the tone of your show kind of felt like that to many of us. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show so that we could discuss it. And I hope you don't feel like we were attacking you. We were just...
It was a good discussion. I'm glad we did this.
I am too. Thank you for being on the show. And Steve...
For inviting me.
Okay. You were just listening to a conversation with Colin McEnroe, who has a show on WNPR, and Steve Forner, a local lawyer and a DJ at WWUH. Colin is one of the few mainstream journalists who has made any effort to do a show exposing the evidence gathered by the 9/11 Truth Movement by doing a show back in April of 2011 on World Trade Center Building 7. And I appreciate his openness for doing that and for coming on the show today. However, Colin still believes that the corporate mainstream media doesn't practice censorship. And as he stated in the conversation you just heard, if there were really something to the counter-narrative of 9/11, then journalists and authors would be out there writing about it. Well, many people have written books about it. They've done books, they've articles, websites. But the only ones that get any attention by the corporate media are the ones that parrot the official story. Just check your local library and see how many books are out there by people in the 9/11 Truth Movement. And I want to give an example of media censorship by relating what attorney William Pepper said about the Martin Luther King trial in 1999. He said, and you can go to the website ct911truth.org to see the video of this speech that was given in 2007 at a conference in West Hartford. He said that the media would not allow any of their reporters to attend the trial. And one journalist violated that ban and went to the trial anyway and was fired for doing so. And of course, the trial revealed that the Martin Luther King assassination was a conspiracy involving J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, the military, the local Memphis police, and organized crime. There's also an organization and a website dedicated to telling the stories that are censored by the corporate media, and that is projectcensored.org. And they're never at a loss for stories. And then concerning censorship, there's a statement made by former CIA Director William Colby, quote, "The Central Intelligence Agency owns everyone of any significance in the major media." Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Has said in one of her books that there are over 400 CIA agents in the corporate media. While Colin was here sharing the dilemmas the corporate media struggles with on whether or not to cover these fringe positions, as they were referred to on his show, there are 1,774 architects and engineers stating that the science of the official story of 9/11 is fraudulent. And there are former leaders of other countries working on getting an international investigation into 9/11. And there are over 80% of the U.S. citizens questioning the official story of 9/11. But I suppose none of this is newsworthy. And on a final note today, I do agree with Colin that some of the questions and theories coming out about Sandy Hook are totally ridiculous. But having said that, I too have some questions about Sandy Hook, such as who shot the holes in one of the teachers' cars in the parking lot that day? And why have the authorities put a gag order on talking about the cars? So I say to all you hockey moms out there, don't stop questioning your government until you're satisfied with their answers. Don't let guys like the four that were on Colin's January 24th show ridicule you into silence. And now I want to tell you about our progressive movie night. We'll be showing the film Weight of Chains on Thursday, February 28th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. Weight of Chains explores the hidden facts that have recently come to light about the destruction of the country that used to be called Yugoslavia. This documentary gives us some inconvenient historical information about the role and true motives of the U.S., NATO, and the European Union in the breakup of this once peaceful and prosperous country. The film explores the current economic situation in the countries of the former Yugoslavia and how institutions like the World Bank and the IMF are using foreign economic takeovers and debt to turn these countries into the new colonies of the international 1%. It's won several awards, so please come out on Thursday, February 28th to see Weight of Chains. And again, that will be in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall, 7 p.m. on the campus of the University of Hartford. And on a really final note today, I want to thank David Schoenfeld for his technical support in the production of this show. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.